Blog Talk Radio.
Movie Geeks United. We have a special show tonight highlighting two new independent films, so let's get right to it. Donkey Punch is an extreme thriller that follows seven young adults as they party aboard a luxury yacht in the middle of the ocean. A ruthless fight for survival ensues after one of them dies in a freak accident. Actors Julianne Moore and Sean Brecken recently sat down with us to discuss their new film, which opened in theaters and became available on HDNet Ultra Video on Demand on January 23rd. This marks Sean's feature film debut, having worked extensively in theater. As for Julian, his credits include Spin, Valkyrie, and Cry Wolf, and you can also see him this final season of ER as Dr. Andrew Wade. This conversation here was a lot of fun, so I hope you guys enjoy it. This is Sean Brecken and Julianne Moore for Donkey Punch.
We're taking our clothes off for the interview.
That's fantastic. Most of our guests do that, so that's terrific. Congratulations on the film.
Thank you.
I wanted to get a sense from both of you guys how this project came about for you and if there was an audition involved. Sean, if you want to start out with that.
The audition process was really quite important. It went on for a long time, about 3 or 4 months. And initially it was a meeting with the casting director, and then slowly throughout the auditions they kind of built a different cast together to see how we would get along and what our relationships were like. For me, I'd seen Dead Man's Shoes, which is a British film made by Warp, which I really liked because it was really brave and really challenging. So I kind of really wanted to be on the film because it was Warp in charge of it, and I thought it's quite a challenging script, but I thought they were a really trusted company, so it made me really excited about the film.
And what was your experience like, Julian?
In terms of the auditioning?
Yeah.
So we're just switching places right now.
We've got the chair that you answer the questions in.
Yes, we have. There's a single phone. I read the script, fell in love with it, met with Oliver Blackburn, who I was told was a first-time director. I still don't believe that because he directs with the confidence and ease of someone who's been doing it for decades. Was incredibly excited and enthusiastic about his vision for the film. Have you seen the film?
I haven't received it yet. It's in the mail. So I think I'm speaking with Oliver next week, with Ollie next week.
Send him our best. So there's another part I was originally submitted for, but I was deeply interested and couldn't get the character of Josh out my head for many reasons. And asked if I could instead go in and read for the role of Josh, and I did, and I got it, thankfully, and we got to shoot the movie.
Wow. But this is a really intense, as it's been described, as an extreme thriller. So I'm wondering if there was any kind of fear beyond the normal nerves about starting a film, about tackling this kind of project for either of you.
For me, I hadn't worked on screen before. Donkey Punch was the first thing I did on screen. So I had a fear of that, I suppose. Transferring from stage to screen is very different. And I think what eased it for me was that the six other actors in the film had all worked on screen and just watching them. And everyone was it was a real ensemble feel to the whole piece. So anytime I was unsure of something or I felt like the cast were really supportive, so any sort of initial fears I had were eased when I got on set, really.
Yeah,
I think that was sort of a similar experience for me. the rest of the cast, the director was so unbelievably supportive. And for all of us, there was such a sense of excitement and privilege to be shooting the movie. We were all deeply engrossed and enthusiastic over the script. And that sort of drove this great camaraderie and spirit of teamwork. And I've never had a project that I've done where I've remained such good friends with the rest of the cast. I mean, all of us are so super close. And whether it was experiencing this together or at Sundance or the shooting of the movie, it's just been brilliant.
Well, I think it was really well cast. I think they were particular about the kind of people that they picked and thinking that they would get on with each other. And then because the shoot was so intense, it was like 24 days to do the film, we just all naturally bonded, I think, and it's been...
Yeah,
we feel like we've all had an amazing experience shooting the film.
For sure.
It was so intense.
And then that does help when you have a scene like the orgy, which demands total ease from
and trust
from the participants. And we had that when we shot it, so we were totally comfortable with each other. And it also helps with the acting, in the fear, in the adrenaline, and all that helps to create that tight, claustrophobic sense of bewilderment that these characters are feeling.
Yeah. Julian, you mentioned that your director here and how supportive he was. And I'm wondering, particularly for those really tough scenes, how did that manifest itself? How did he help you?
Well, I think for me personally, the best thing a director can ever do is take a step back. Let me do my work and let me put my interpretation or give my interpretation, but at the same time be there sort of like guiding and giving notes when needed. Experienced directors, I find, do that, and that's what Oliver did. Certainly, Josh's change in character, he starts off as this quite awkward, shy, deeply insecure young man, and then after he commits this outrageous murder through a donkey punch, it becomes this sort of desperate need to survive and to get off the boat and live the rest of his life. And Oliver and his notes helped me so much. You know, he gave me music to listen to that he thought Josh might listen to. He gave me a backstory on the character. And he just, you know, his notes are terrific.
You talk about the music. Were there films that he referenced or suggested that you see?
He actually made me a compilation CD, and I think he did it for you as well, Sean, right?
I think for all the characters, he kind of gave us a guideline of what kind of films and what kind of music the characters might be into, which was great because it was a real insight to what Ollie wanted to achieve. And then for me, you know, I watch films that personally I would never watch, which was a great insight to Lisa and what kind of character she was. So Ollie was very sort of method in his directing.
And also the films that Oliver and I both love, you know, Straw Dogs, many of Peckinpah's films, Belle du Jour, those films are also referenced in ways, and you'll recognize them when you see the film, particularly Straw Dogs. And that's when I read the script, it was the one film that I thought rang most for me. And
yeah.
But I think the interesting thing about that was that we had no idea what Ollie had given the other characters. So for me, that's the first time I've heard that Julian watched Straw Dogs. I watched Moulin Rouge, which is completely different, you know, and I think, exactly, I think, yeah, you know, that's, and how different that was is that for Lisa, she's just out having a good time, and for Josh, it's much more complicated, and I think that's really interesting that Ollie kept that from us, and so our character development was really in-depth.
I also watched Lassie. That was just a pleasure.
Tell me about the atmosphere of shooting a thriller like this. Is it kind of more energetic or more kind of fraught with tension actually on the set than your usual movie outside of this kind of genre?
Well, here's the thing. We were all of us on this boat, and it was a relatively small space. The hours that we were working were long. We once did a 21-hour day. And because we were in character, not necessarily by choice, but just because we were filming the scenes all day long for so many hours and around each other, it created this enormous tension and intensity among us and on set, and excitement,
totally.
Not a bad thing, but it works great for the film. And of course, in because of the film that it is, because it is so disturbing, because the subject matter is so dark, so graphic, and so extreme, those feelings and that sense of tension, the way your heart tightens and pounds in your chest, that's all great and works terrific for the cinema, and I think it translates well and translates well for the viewer.
Yeah. And when this plays in front of an audience, when you've been in the audience watching this, for instance, at Sundance, which I would imagine that was a remarkable experience, what do you find that they get out of it? What is their reaction to it?
I tell you what, when it was filmed, when it was shown at Sundance, I think this was the Park City screening, this during the orgy, and just after the donkey punch, this woman leapt out of her seat, ran out of the aisle, then proceeded to vomit in the foyer.
No way.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
Can
great.
You believe that?
No way.
The I forget her name, I probably shouldn't say it, but what was that columnist for the Daily Mail?
Oh, Amanda Patel.
Amanda Patel, who's this big
really
columnist, really right-wing columnist. I mean, thing like Bill O'Reilly. She
right.
did this huge, big spread in one of the most popular papers in Britain, describing it as the most vile film in history, and saying that it should be banned outright. Now,
that's
I guess,
fantastic.
Which is great, yeah. But it's the sort of movie that we set out to make. We wanted to make, because it's so honest, because it's so real. You know, it's as graphic as Saw and Hostel, but because the horror isn't fantastical, it comes from this reality, this very real situation that we could all, you and I, could both find ourselves in. And the enemy isn't some supernatural being.
No.
It's ourselves
yeah.
and us.
It's a situation, isn't it, and how people respond to the situation, which is an interesting thing. And because the characters are so well developed, hopefully that you can identify with that and think, how would I respond in this situation myself?
And I think that's also probably why it makes it so unnerving and disturbing to watch, because there isn't that disassociation that naturally occurs when it is a fantasy.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
it's real
yeah,
and
yeah.
based in reality, it's that much more harrowing and disturbing to watch.
Yeah, but when you both watch it, being in it, can you separate, does it work for you from an audience perspective, or can you not separate the experience of shooting it while you're watching it?
I think it's changed for me a lot. Like, the first time you watch it, you're kind of emotionally very involved in it and how you feel about the other actors and about how your character and your own experience. And then, like, we shot it in 2007, so a year and a half, 2 years ago.
Mm.
And so now when I watch it, and especially watching it in America, it's very different again, and you're thinking how an audience responds to it. And I think there are, you know, it is a naive film, isn't it? But I think that's what's lovely about it and what's exciting about it as well. There are big mistakes in it, and there are amazing moments to be proud of. And I think, but, you know, it's a young cast, and it's a young filmmakers, and I think that's why it works.
Totally. I mean, just for me, I'm immensely proud of it. And I think that it's a film with legs, I think. And I say this immodestly, but I really believe this is true. I think in 10 years, 15 years, people will be referencing Donkey Punch. And I'm really proud of it.
Yeah. What's next for you guys? Julian, I know you were doing... Are you still shooting ER?
Yeah, I'm still involved with that. I've been fortunate enough to be involved in the final season of ER, playing Dr. Andrew Wade.
Dr. Andrew Wade!
Yeah, American. So,
Andrew, I broke my leg.
Let
what
me fix it,
you
my dummy.
You guys had big news this week with Clooney coming back.
Isn't it great?
Yes, that's great.
Fantastic. I'm thrilled. And in fact, the funny thing was, Anthony Edwards, who played Dr. Green, as you know, he came back.
He's
and
cool.
he's No, he left ages ago.
No, he came back?
He came back.
He's never won. He's
won. No, he's not. He came back though as well. And they're all coming back. They're all coming back. It's good. It's all good. And I just did this movie called Sorority Row, which I think your audiences will be interested in. It's through Summit Entertainment, which are the people behind Twilight. It's going to be pretty big at the end of this year. And it's another horror, but in the same vein as I Know What You Did Last Summer, Scream.
Which
is very different and unusual for movies that have been released in the last few years.
Well, I want you to come back when that opens. I want you to come back. And Sean, how about you? What are you up to?
I've been working with the BBC in England, which is one of the main television networks there, on a series, actually, with Nicola, who plays Tammy, which was nice to be reunited with her. And we play two bunny girls in the 60s, and it's all about investigating how the police scene is corrupt in the 60s.
Oh, very cool. All right. Well, guys, thank you so much for your time, and best of luck to you both. You guys are great.
Thanks for having us.
So are you. I enjoy the film. Thanks for covering it.
Take care. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You didn't put your clothes on.
Sorry.
All right, that's Sean Brecken and Julianne Moores, two of the lead actors from the new extreme thriller Donkey Punch, which is now available on demand, and it also opened in theaters on that same day. Now we shift gears a little bit to another independent film. Courting Condi is a musical docu-tragic comedy about one man's bid to win the heart of the world's most powerful woman. I'm speaking, of course, of Condoleezza Rice. The man behind the camera on this unique hybrid is Sebastian Doggart. We spoke to Doggart about the film and its reception and a screening that will take place in a couple of days that will actually find this controversial film greeting Miss Rice as she begins her first day at Stanford University. This is a very interesting conversation about a fascinating film. Here's Sebastian talking about Courting Condi. Tell me, first of all, before we get into Courting Condi, about your background, because just a fascinating, colorful background. Did you originally set out to be a journalist and not a filmmaker?
I originally wanted to be a professional football player, soccer player, but I wasn't good enough. A little like Condoleezza Rice and her piano playing, I realized I wasn't good enough. So then I wanted to be a journalist and pursued that for several years in Latin America before I went up to university at Cambridge. And I wrote a book on the Argentine economy after I'd fallen in love, and that hadn't worked out. And then at university, I became more interested in Latin American theater and drama, and translated and directed a number of Latin American plays. And then went to learn the craft of theater directing, drama directing. And that led me into television, and I worked for a show called The South Bank Show, which does biographies of extraordinary people. And then I went to live in Los Angeles, continued working in television, and then came to New York and worked in the wickednesses of the reality TV industry for shows like Project Runway. And then I came across this extraordinary character, Condoleezza Rice, who's haunted my nightmares for the last 3 years.
Oh, well, we're definitely going to touch upon that. But tell me what your what inspired you to get into journalism, and were those inspirations any of the same that drew you to filmmaking and theater as well?
I think telling amazing stories, a fascination of the great stories that have been told. You know, in Latin, I lived in Peru for a year in my first journalistic sort of training, and this is a country riven by this Shining Path guerrilla group and hyperinflation, and just extraordinary lives were taking place, very different from the pretty comfortable life that I had been brought up in. So I've always been fascinated by other lives, and then, you know, the fortune to be able to make friends with people like Shakespeare through directing their work and trying to understand them and talking to them and trying to make the very good very even slightly better. So I think a fascination with extraordinary people is a running thread.
Mm-hmm. And what about Condoleezza Rice did you find extraordinary and fascinating?
Well, I've always been fascinated by powerful women. I used to have inappropriate fantasies about Margaret Thatcher growing up. She was naked, wearing nothing but an apron and with a ladle scolding me. Telling me I was a very naughty boy. And then as a theater director, I reimagined King Lear as a woman and was exploring how power affects women rather than men, and the whole hysteria on the Heath. Because I was very interested in Lear's exploration of powerful women. And then in television, I did a show for A&E about Madonna, the most powerful entertainer who's ever lived, perhaps. So I guess there's a logic then to be exploring the most powerful woman on the planet, as she was, according to Forbes magazine, when I first became inspired by her about sort of 2005, when she became Secretary of State.
Do they have women in positions of power as you found them? Do they have any kind of similar attributes about them, personality traits?
I think power corrupts men and women in many, many similar ways. And certainly the temptation for certain women to be the first most powerful woman is even more intoxicating. And Thatcher had it as the first prime minister, female prime minister, and Madonna certainly had it, because you have all these sycophants around you saying, you're amazing, you're the first person to do it, and you're a hero of mine, and that just goes to your head, and it gives you a hubris, and I think that tragedy can make the fall then even more extreme. When you see the kind of the tears of Thatcher leaving number 10, you see the kind of loneliness that Madonna is starting to fall into now, and you're going to see the same loneliness, I think, with Condoleezza Rice. So I think it's similar in many ways, but particularly for single women like Madonna and Margaret Thatcher after the death of her husband, and Condoleezza Rice, it's particularly hard.
So tell me, first of all, tell our audience a little bit about Court and Condi. The kind of genesis behind how you structure this film.
Well, Court and Condi is a musical docu-tragic comedy. It's the first musical docu-tragic comedy ever. And the reason that we use this hybrid is to explore the essence of this extraordinary woman. I wanted to shine light on a woman who's changed all our lives, but we know very little about. She once said that she wanted to leave power without anyone knowing where she stands on any of the issues. And that was a kind of red rag to a bull in terms of revealing who she is. But she's a very musical person, and to find the essence of her, we felt we needed to try and find a musical way in. So the hero of the film, who's in love with Condoleezza Rice, writes what he calls love discs to win her heart, and we were very inspired by the kind of very eclectic music that she's into. It's also a comedy because we felt that straight documentaries commercially don't do very well. We wanted to put a lot of bums on seats and to make people laugh about politics is something The Daily Show does so well, and we thought it was important to entertain. And then it's a documentary. All of the characters in the film are from Brent Scowcroft to her childhood friends to Lawrence Wilkerson, who was Colin Powell's chief of staff and sat with her in the basement of the White House when she was ordering torture to take place. These are all real people telling real stories. There's no authorial voiceover from me, or these are real people, and I would put it up to the standards of any political documentary. But finally, and it's a tragedy. It's an American tragedy of a woman who could have done amazing things for America, for women, for African Americans, for many groups, and because of her personal obsession with power, she tragically failed to do that.
Mm-hmm. Now, from what you've just described and from viewing the film, obviously I can attest to this, that's a whole lot to kind of, a lot of tones, because it's very funny, and at the same time it's a very intimate portrait of Rice. It brings up some very serious issues. Was there a fear of juggling the tones of this film and making them mesh?
Yeah, very much so. We had we had 10 months editing it, taking 300 hours down to an hour and 40 minutes. We had a lot of test screenings. I anguished a great deal over how to make this work, how to keep it entertaining and yet inform audiences about things they just don't know. But I think what I found was this is the structure of a love affair is very useful, because in a love affair, we do have a lot of laughter and a lot of joy and a lot of happiness, often at the beginning of that love affair. And then as we get to know the person more, we start seeing the toenails in the bathtub. We start seeing the dark side. And then there's often a disillusion, and there's an anger, and there's an explosion, and sometimes we look back with regret about those love affairs. So I use that structure to try and create a balance between the comedy and the tragedy.
I'm wondering, any of these kind of amazing people that you interview in the film, when you described what you were attempting with this film, if any of them were kind of skeptical about the whole thing?
A lot of people refuse to go on camera. Condoleezza Rice particularly, and she's done her best to block this film. But Madeleine Albright, who I definitely wanted to interview, but she declined very politely, but she said it wasn't right for a former Secretary of State to criticize a sitting Secretary of State. But she said she was not very complimentary about Dr. Rice, and particularly about the legacy that she claimed to have pushed forward of her father, Joseph Corbell, who was also Condoleezza Rice's mentor in a strange quirk of history. But other people, we were pretty straight up. We said, you know, we had Frank Luntz, who was the guy behind Schwarzenegger getting into office and Jeb Bush getting into office, and he was fully aware that we were, that Devin was in love with Condoleezza Rice, and that aspect is a film, but he was certainly putting himself on the line for, in terms of some of his Republican friends, for making fun of her.
Right. And in terms of the comedy, Devin is just he's terrific, hysterical in this film. He's just great. Tell me about working with him, and what made you choose Devin for to lead this film?
Well, I'm very fortunate to be able to work with Devin. I think Devin is one of the undiscovered great stars of American comedy. He should be up there with Belushi and John Candy in this literally larger-than-life genius that he has in terms of comedy. I've worked with him first on an MTV show with a lot of improv actors, and he stood out in that group with his timing, with his clever, ribald use of physical comedy at the same time, a great intelligence. He has great humanity. His parents feature in the film, as his parents, and they've helped to inspire that, and I'm deeply grateful for them to. I think we made a good team. I'm British, he's American. You know, we have different styles, and he's a dear friend of mine, and I'm proud to work with him. Of course, everyone knows him as Buzz in Home Alone,
right?
Which, in a world of celebritocracy, can't help in terms of promoting our film. I'm down here at the moment in Florida for this festival, and everyone knows him. They recognize him, and they say, "Oh my goodness, you're Buzz from Home Alone! Wow, you've grown up."
Wow. Yeah, he's just fantastic in this film. Now you have the screening and the award ceremony this weekend there at Florida, as you said. But you also have an upcoming screening in L.A. Is it on the 4th, is it?
We have an upcoming screening at Stanford on the 3rd, and then at UCLA on the 4th, yes. And we're excited about that. It's a big the Ackerman Auditorium, and we're using it really to try and secure distribution, which is our mm-hmm. next step. You know, we've won 7 awards on the festival circuit and got great reviews, but you know, we need to get the money now, and we need
right.
to sell this film, because
yeah.
a lot of people have put a lot of time and effort for free until now, or on deferred basis. I'm $225,000 in the hole on this personally. So the ordeal of making a film like this is commercially justified only if we can get a sale, and the situation at the moment is very, very bad in the independent film sector. There's no credit for new films. A lot of the old indie distributors have collapsed, and you see a greater conservatism in the studios and the TV companies in terms of what material they're putting out. They'd much prefer to put Spider-Man 26 or Madagascar 15 than anything that pushes
yeah.
the boundaries.
Yeah, and then this film certainly does. But are you hoping for a theatrical release, or what do you see this kind of? Where do you see the perfect venue for this film?
Well, recent films like Man on Wire, for example, have
right.
done well theatrically, and of course, Fahrenheit 9/11, which did gross $250 million worldwide. I don't think there's any reason why we can't be commercially successful. I've sat in cinemas and heard audiences laugh and enjoy the film. It's entertainment. It's good entertainment. So
yeah.
I think people should take the risk, and I think it could do like Borat did. I was at college with Sacha Baron Cohen, and we were both, you know, making our own little shows at Cambridge. And then he gets Borat, and that's $400 million in the can, thank you very much, even though he actually saw nothing there, because Fox took everything, and he took nothing. So, but there's no reason why.
Yeah, I agree. But you mentioned the audience reaction and how much they enjoy this. Could you expand upon that a little bit? Tell me what they come up and say to you after a screening of this film.
Well, yesterday, the chairman of Marriott, who is a rabid Republican, or was a rabid Republican, came up to me afterwards and said, I had absolutely no idea these things were going on, and I have changed my political views after seeing it. Mm. And this information just wasn't out there. That was from the right, and then from the left I had the ACLU, Civil Liberties Union, come up to me and say, we want to screen this again as a fundraiser. And then a lot of people just saying that they laughed a great deal and they learnt a lot. And I think if that's, as a director, one of the greatest compliments, if you can entertain and somehow inform.
Yeah,
I've done my job.
Yeah, and in terms of your own personal view on Condoleezza Rice and this administration that is has now left, tell me what surprised you the most about her and her journey, and how your thoughts on her were kind of morphed over the course of this film.
Well, when I first started exploring her, I just thought she was an amazing woman who was telling the story of America, really, growing up in civil rights, and then she's kind of like the other side of the Obama story in some ways. Mm-hmm. Although I didn't quite see it then, I now see her as the sort of dark side of the Obama tale. You know, Rosa Parks would be jumping up and down and joyful at seeing Obama take office, but would be turning in her grave at what Condoleezza Rice has done in terms of using the civil rights legacy for her own personal gain. And I think what was most amazed me is the media have portrayed her completely inaccurately, and she has managed to fly beneath the radar, which is great for me because it means I have a story to tell. But
right.
They just won't. Laura Flanders in the film talks about it's the racism of the media that is responsible for this. I think there's some truth. The fact that she's a black woman has been used by the Republican Party and by herself to get ahead, and the media are frightened of criticizing her. But is it appropriate for a woman who's told as many untruths to return to a cushy job at Stanford? Is it appropriate that we should not hold her accountable for breaking the law, for breaking the Constitution, the treaties on UN conventions on torture? She has clearly broken the law. Should Congress or the International Criminal Court, if Obama joins that court, be trying her for war crimes?
Right.
Or should he be moving on? As Obama has said, he's got this dilemma. Do we hold these people accountable, or do we move on? And I think it's a very interesting crossroads. I, as a filmmaker, just want to ask those questions, and I think we need to ask a lot more questions. Exactly what happened there? Why did they break the law like this? And exactly, history needs to know this, and we need to make sure that it doesn't happen again.
We're going to push this film really hard, and I love the film, and I congratulate you on it, and please give us updates on the progress of the distribution and the other festivals that it's playing in, and we'll post them to our listeners.
Great. Well, we have 16 festivals this year, which have been accepted into, from Phuket to India, from Singapore to South Africa to Durango, which is coming up in Colorado. So it should be a chance for your listeners, hopefully, to see some of the film at some point.
Now,
and
let
then
me ask
you.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And if your listeners want to view a trailer of the film, there's one at courtingcondi.com and some outtakes from the film and things like that. So that's also an opportunity.
Let me ask you one more question before I let you go. You mentioned the international festivals and screenings that you have. Is there a different reaction overseas than here in the States?
I think it's a little bit more reserved, and in Britain, the responses in audiences. Florida audiences seem to absolutely love it.
Mm-hmm.
We've now been in three festivals here, in Fort Lauderdale, Orlando, and now Treasure Coast. And New York ones are a bit more cerebral as well, closer to London. And I've had questions in London about why don't you explore more about the British complicity in you know, corporate cronyism and the torture and lies. But it's not really the story. But so I haven't. I'm looking forward to seeing it in Egypt, for example. I'm looking forward to where Arab perceptions of Rice and the administration are complicated. So I'm looking forward to that because it's a new world now that Obama's here, and it's history, and this is the first retrospective of the Bush administration, and I don't think we've ever seen such a radical change in direction for America.
Yeah. Do you see that there's other aspects of this that you'd like to explore once this film is picked up and it's out there?
Well, what I've done now is I've cut a new film without Tevin, without comedy and without musical elements, but on the request of Amnesty International. So it's just testimony from everyone from Henry Kissinger to Scowcroft to Bush Sr. And an archive as a straight documentary. Stanford were concerned about some of the sort of irreverent jokes about her. So I think there's a role in presenting the historical and some facts there. And we're screening that for the first time on Tuesday at Stanford, where she returns on the same day. So
really?
To kind of welcome her at the same time as... It's called American Faust, From Condi to Neo-Condi. I think... there's going to be some demonstrations as well to protest why she's coming back to Stanford. I mean, what example is this to Stanford students? And she right. didn't check the facts on weapons of mass destruction. She did tell fibs to the 9/11 Commission, and she's responsible for torture and possibly for war crimes. Is this really someone you want to be teaching your kids?
Are the nerves going about Tuesday? I mean, is this a particularly nerve-wracking screening on Tuesday, or is this the one you're most excited about?
She blocked a screening at Stanford, which caused a big media hoo-ha, and Condi's cronies cancel courting Condi was one headline. So I don't know how she's going to stop Amnesty screening it. I'm excited. I think I've just become an American citizen, and to be able to exercise my rights under the First Amendment is exciting. And I feel
fantastic.
I was asked,
yeah.
becoming a citizen in the leaflet, it said, you know, make sure you vote, make sure you write articles and fulfill a civic responsibility. And I do treat that very seriously, and I'm honored to be a citizen of this country, but I'm also aware of the responsibilities I now have.
Yeah. Well, I love the film, man, and I'm rooting for you all the way. Please come back. Please keep us informed.
Great. Well, thank you very much for spreading the word, and I'm becoming a regular listener to your show. So.
Thank you, Sebastian.
Good luck with all your endeavors.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye now.
Okay. Take care. Bye.
Okay, Sebastian Doggart for Courting Condi, and my co-host Jerry is here with me. Hey, Jerry.
Hey, okay, I have something to add to that. That does sound like a fascinating film, but he's right. Dr. Rice told a massive, massive lie to the 9/11 Commission when those
right.
hearings were going on. She said, we had no idea they were going to use planes as missiles. This is false because we have two instances where this has happened in the past. 1995 in Paris, they thwarted a plot where they're going to use a plane to go into the Eiffel Tower.
Right.
But the other one is the basis for the film The Assassination of Richard Nixon, which is based on a true story.
Which is one of my favorite films of the
past
5 or so years. Yeah, I love
and
that
we
film.
Knew
Nobody talks about it.
But everyone actually, ever since that incident in this like in counterterrorism training, that's one of the things they're trained in. They've known about the plane for over 30 years they knew that this was a
well,
story.
I think the most immediate is they had the memo, the anonymous
yeah.
memo there that talked about the possibility
yeah,
just,
I,
you
yeah.
know, 9 months earlier.
I don't know if I get a memo like there, you get anything, a meteor is going to hit your house or, their car coming, you're going to respond. That still is one of the most the most insane things. You get a memo, August 6th, you know, which is ironically the anniversary of Hiroshima. You know, the date of that is within itself frightening.
Yeah.
Has frightening implications. And you're like, hey, I'm going to go clear brush. You know?
Well, this is my question in terms of how it relates to films. You think now that we have the new administration, everyone has the feeling of a new beginning, are we going to see less and less kind of investigations in the cinema on the previous administration?
It's a double-edged sword because we are going through something quite catastrophic with the economy. And I think people really are focused. He has to really, I read earlier today, someone said, you basically have to pull a rabbit out of a hat, don't you? That's what someone told him, I mean, at a dinner last night. And, you know, everyone, that's really the major thing. This is getting, while everything that happened the last 8 years needs to be investigated, I do have a feeling it's going to be pushed away for now, because it's just the economy is and getting people jobs, and this year is going to be worse than last year. Trying to fix the economy is the major thing right now. This is what happened in the last 8 years is very important and needs to be taken care of. People do need to be held accountable.
The movies, particularly the documentaries, have been very responsible in terms of their investigation of these past 8 years, and we discussed that with Maurice Alberti from The Wrestler the other week, and she feels the same way, and she's made some herself, like Taxi to the Dark Side, and that kind of thing. So I think you look to documentaries at this time to, if you're a movie fan.
We don't even know most of the stuff. We're going to be finding out stuff for years to come. That's going to really make us angrier and everything. And what's been interesting, if people have told, like Cheney and Rumsfeld, don't leave the country.
Right.
Because we can't protect you. They could be arrested and tried for war crimes, especially Cheney.
I'm interested in this the tone of movies, because last year, if you remember last year, all the acclaimed movies, even more so than usual, and the biggest movie of last year, they were all downers.
Yeah.
and it was kind of reflective of we're thinking. It's not reflective of what the society feels right now. I'm wondering if that tone will shift now.
I hope. I think it could. I mean, I think it is a possibility. It really depends, you know, first and foremost, like I said, the economy. But it does depend on things. But, I mean, look, people, even with all the bad things that are going on, I think a majority of the people are willing to put their trust in Obama. I think they obviously would much rather have him at the helm of the ship than who's been at the helm for the last 8 years. I know I'm happy. I'm relieved to know that this is the one I want.
I think the movies are shifting. You know my prime evidence of that?
Paul Blart Mall Cop.
That's it. You got it.
Well, that would have done well. I mean, it's really scary. That would have done well regardless. But it does well right now because people just want to go just – turn off their brain and just laugh a lot at silly stuff, and I understand that perfectly.
Yeah, if it wins Best Picture next year, that'll be the major turnaround, I think.
Well, it might go over better than what's been nominated this year. but
Danny Boyle won the DGA.
Okay, I think then unless then it is Slumdogs to lose.
Yeah,
I really do think, and that will be, if anything beats Slumdog, that will be considered a major upset.
Waltz with Bashir won the DGA.
Yeah, I think that's a shoe-in.
You know, I love Slumdog. I do. I'm not crazy about the thought of it beating out movies that I feel are more have more to say and are more accomplished.
Right, but I think Slumdog is going to be the one that wins.
But you can't. It's like you're killing kittens when you say anything bad about Slumdog.
Yeah, I know. It really upsets me,
I am I'm constantly scrutinized by it.
Okay, let me ask you this. And we've talked about this before, obviously, on our big Oscar prediction. Forget who's going to win. Who do you want to win that's nominated?
Who do I want to win that is nominated?
For Best Picture.
The Curious Case of Benjamin Button.
Okay, who would you really want to win that isn't nominated? What is the best picture that you feel should be in there that's not, and that you would like to see win?
Two movies that I would have liked to have seen nominated for Best Picture, and that's The Dark Knight and Doubt.
Okay.
And honestly, I think The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, the complaints about it is that it doesn't go straight to people's hearts or whatever. You and I have discussed this. I think it's a fable that should live on for a long, long time. And I think its ambition and its execution alone makes it a Oscar time vault kind of movie.
Yeah, I see that. And I disagree. You know, people say it's just like a Forrest Gump 2, and I could see that maybe for the first third of the film where you could come up with that. But then, look, you want to know, Forrest Gump is Zelig for dummies as far as I'm concerned. If you want to know the honest truth how I feel about Forrest Gump. And I do like Forrest Gump, but if you want, that's how I would describe it as. It's not like for dummies, because it does have that feel to it.
Betty Jo's voting for Mamma Mia.
Well,
now,
it's not up there. That would have been a choice they might have wanted to consider, too. I mean, that was a crowd pleaser, a huge crowd pleaser. You know, so that was totally shut out.
I just saw it. I mean, I hadn't seen it. I just watched it Friday night.
Right.
It was on the demand. I'm too lazy to go to the video store, so I just pressed a button and watched it.
Hey, that's the way to do it. Way to do it. No, cool. I think Benjamin Button, it didn't hit me while watching it. The more I thought about it, the more I liked it, you know, the more, you know, after a couple of days, and I really, you know, it grew on me. But if that wins, you know, that's going to be considered a major upset.
Oh, yeah.
A big upset.
I don't think there are a lot of surprises up for grabs this. The surprise will be, I wonder what different things they'll do with the actual show. Baz Luhrmann is, it's rumored that he's choreographing a musical number for Hugh Jackman.
Mm-hmm.
And that should be, that could be impressive. I mean,
that would actually be a plus, because Hugh Jackman's a great singer, but he's a great performer, so that could be very good. I wouldn't rule that out at all.
The BAFTA nominations are out, huh? Betty Jo just said that it was nominated for Best Film. I haven't seen the BAFTA nominations yet.
Oh, I don't remember.
You?
I know they came out a couple of weeks ago.
Why haven't I seen them?
I don't know. They've been there. They're online.
Why is that lame? That I didn't. I guess that.
No, you're not lame. Not at all. No, but they are out there. You just type it into Google and find it. But I think it's like I said. I think Slumdog has won, and if it doesn't win, it's the big upset.
Yeah.
And I'd be curious to see what I do think The Reader does not belong in there. Neither, and this love affair they have with Stephen Daldry, I really don't understand.
Yeah.
I don't get that.
They have. I guess this is the same thing as the BAFTAs. Yeah. They have the same nominations that we do for Best Picture. And then they have the Outstanding British Film, on which Slumdog is also there with Man on Wire, Mamma Mia, and Bruges, and a movie called Hunger.
Hunger has been good. I've heard a lot about it. I've obviously never seen it, but I've heard a lot about it.
Director, Daldry's still there with Ron Howard, Fincher, Danny Boyle, but Clint Eastwood's in there for Changeling as well.
For Changeling, oh, okay. But what is this love affair with Stephen Daldry? I think we should do a whole show. Maybe we need to do a whole director retrospective on the films of Stephen Daldry.
Bring Stephen Daldry on. Why do people love you so much?
Yeah, dude, what is it with you, man? I mean, do you feel that? Is it true that Chris Nolan and Darren Aronofsky are hunting you down as we speak?
Probably. I would think so. Most of them fall in line with the American Academy Awards, too. Except you got Tilda Swinton up for supporting for Burn After Reading, and Frida Pinto for Slumdog for supporting as well.
People really wanted to see some of the cast of Slumdog get nominations in our country. They're hoping for that. What is it with the British, the BAFTAs? Are they like Tony Blair to Bush? I mean, they just go along with us. I mean,
have you watched the BAFTAs yet before?
No, I've never watched them. I always just get to read the results online. I've never actually had a chance to watch them.
Yeah. It's like a more reserved Oscars. Like Britain is a more reserved place than America.
I don't know how true that's going to be soon, but But is there, I mean, we haven't talked, or maybe we did talk about this, but I was shocked last week that Streep won for Doubt at the SAG and Sean Penn. I shouldn't be shocked, I mean, that Sean Penn won, because it is between those two, Sean Penn and Mickey Rourke. But they now say that because of Sean Penn's win, he's the favorite to win the best actor,
right,
the Oscars, which I'm like, oh, God, if Mickey, come on, Mick, you got to do this.
Yeah. It'd be great to see him do it.
I would love to see him do it.
But it's out of his hands, obviously.
Oh, of course, of course.
Yeah. But I'm not sure. I mean, that did definitely throw a question mark into the whole thing.
Let me ask you this: what kind of riot do you think would break out if Heath Ledger did not win?
Oh.
I mean, that's the.
I think they'd see many, many millions of people turning off the TV right now.
Yeah, I think people would just turn it off. It would be dead. It would be dead.
Yeah.
Dead. I mean, there's just no, you couldn't.
The Nielsen ratings would just plummet. They're going to plummet anyway after they announce him as the winner, but
mm-hmm.
Even more so if he didn't win it. And speaking of Nielsen's, they just laid off 32,000 people, Nielsen's.
Let's not start talking about that. That's very depressing. I don't know. I honestly don't know if that, you know, obviously that's the economy and everything, but I also don't know if that's whether we're witnessing also a technological seismic shift, though, as well. These aren't just the results of that too, but the 32,000 is a scary number. It's every day there are these numbers in the thousands that are just of people getting laid off, and it is truly frightening. And you look at also the Washington Post is getting rid of certain sections of their paper, as the LA Times did a couple of years ago. It's just the society, things are changing at a rapid rate.
Did you watch Taken this weekend?
Yes, I did, and I liked it. I enjoyed it. I mean, it's not the best movie I ever saw, but certainly for a January release, it's above average.
Yeah.
I would recommend it.
Taken was number one this weekend with 24.5 million.
Which was very nice.
Yeah.
It was very
nice
to see Paul Blart get knocked off.
Only Liam Neeson with his badassery could knock off Paul Blart.
There's already a Paul Blart 2, I heard.
Oh, there should be. It's already at $83.5 million.
It's going to be a trilogy.
I think it cost 39 cents to make. It's really showed a profit. The Uninvited, that's Elizabeth Banks, right?
Isn't that the remake of a Korean film, actually? A Korean horror film, A Tale of Two Sisters.
They all are now.
Yeah, they are all remakes. They're all... But let me see, what else... Now, Taken was the only thing I thought worthwhile to see this weekend.
That came in third with $10.5 million. Hotel for Dogs came in 8.7 for fourth place.
Mm-hmm.
And Gran Torino is still holding on to the top five. Slumdog, sixth place. Its total is $67 million so far in the
mm-hmm.
U.S.
But did you see The Reader? Even in this wide, wide release, people aren't going to see it.
Yeah.
So... I think people have Holocaust burnout.
I think they just know that it's depressing. If you look at all the top 10 movies
mm-hmm.
here, none of them are depressing. I mean, they're depressing not in terms of content. They're not depressing.
Yeah, people just don't want to see.
They're depressing that they're doing so well.
Yeah, some of them. Yeah, there are. There's no doubt they're depressing. But no, people don't want to see The Reader. They don't, and they certainly. And speaking of depressing, they don't want to see Revolutionary Road. And the best comment I heard about Revolutionary Road was when I saw The Wrestler and the people behind us after the trailer for Revolutionary Road. Why would we want to go see that? We live that every day.
Right.
So, you know, I was like, thanks for airing out your personal life to us.
And internationally, has already taken $70 million already because it opened last year.
Yeah, it's been out
there.
For a long time, actually, overseas.
Yeah.
It's just coming here, but it's been out for a while.
It's very strange. Very strange.
Yeah, that's very odd.
Got movies coming out the same day in theaters as in TV, and it's all wacky.
It is all wacky. I still want to see Shea, though. I still want to see the Soderbergh film when I have some time.
Yeah, that's on your demand, isn't it?
That's on demand, so I want to check that out.
Yeah, me too. We got some good shows coming up Wednesday night. We could be speaking to Lawrence Grobel, who is very close friends with Al Pacino. And he has a book of interviews out with Al Pacino that's very illuminating, especially if you're someone like me. But outside of that, he's a very accomplished journalist, and he's known as the Mozart of interviewers, so that's not at all intimidating to interview him. He's done legendary profiles on Marlon Brando. He spent like a week in Tahiti with Marlon Brando for a Playboy interview that was in the late 70s. It was very eye-opening. And he's done a series of interviews with Capote, and he wrote a book of those interviews, too. A fascinating guy. We also have two Oscar-nominated makeup artists, John Caglione Jr. from The Dark Knight, and he talks in detail about working with Heath Ledger to craft the Joker's look. And he also talks about being Al Pacino's personal makeup assistant.
Al Pacino night.
Do you find a common thread here? I tell you what. Let me finish up who's on Wednesday night. And then the other Oscar-nominated makeup guy, Mike Elizalde from Hellboy 2. And then we're waiting to hear final word, but I think we're going to have a recorded interview with James Gray as well, who's the director of Two Lovers. Now, Al Pacino, as you know, Jerry, because I've told you.
Yeah, I got a text message.
has been in my small town of Lakeland, Florida for the past week, because he's going to the Super Bowl in Tampa, and it's 45 minutes away. It's not crowded at all, and it's basically the nearest airport that's accepting incoming flights, because Tampa's very busy. So I'm hearing that my idol, my creative idol, the man that I've been after for the past couple of years since I've done the show to interview, is within a 10-mile radius of me. So I did some stalking on Friday.
Oh, my God.
I didn't. I drove downtown. I said, where would he stay? It would probably be this one hotel. But we just drove by, and I looked up in the windows. No, I don't see him in the windows.
There you go.
And then we drove away. But, man, how exciting is that? Apparently, he was here in town. I keep hearing different people. But I hear Christopher Walken.
Wow.
Tom Arnold. Adam Sandler. They were all together.
Wow. Now that would be quite a show.
You'd think that that crew would stick out like a sore thumb,
mm-hmm.
Walking down the street here. But so anyway, that was exciting. That was my little piece of Hollywood in my small podunk Florida town.
Well, that is very exciting. All those guys in your neck of the woods.
Yeah, it was thrilling. So join us back here Wednesday night, 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific, and then we'll be back. The following Sunday, we'll have some great guests, whoever those might be. And then our Friday the 13th show is Wednesday the 11th, a growing number of great interviews with people.
That's going to be a great show. You guys will definitely love that. I mean, we got a lot of great stuff for you for that show. A lot of great things.
The old classic series and some people from the new film. And the new film looks scary. I was with a couple last night, my best friends, and the woman saw the wife saw the commercial and said, that 30-second commercial scares me. I can't go see that movie. So,
well, I think that's
intense.
What people want at this time. You know, we talk about, you know, going, like, seeing the really, like, silly, brainless comedies or whatever. People also just want to escape and, you know, get their witch scared, you know? So this will be the perfect film. I think more so than any of these other ones that have come out, like The Uninvited or The Unborn, I think the Friday the 13th remake will be the one that really does it.
Oh, I think it'll do Big business.
Huge business.
Yeah. So thank you all so very much for joining us tonight.
And enjoy the Super Bowl.
Exactly. Who's going to win, Jerry? Tell me.
I think the Steelers are going to win.
Okay. I'm rooting for the Cardinals because they're they're underdogs. And I'm rooting for Springsteen as well.
Okay. Yeah, me too. All right. Good night,
everybody.
Everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, everybody.